Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we meet a remarkable woman. Growing up in rural Alberta, Canada, Amanda Linhout dreamed of seeing the world she viewed through the pages of National Geographic. Once she reached adulthood, she began to travel, first as a backpacker through Latin America, Southeast Asia, eventually to India, Sudan, Ethiopia, Syria, and Pakistan, and finally began a career as a freelance journalist for stints in Afghanistan and Iraq during the conflicts there. In August 2008, she and her photojournalist companion, Nigel Brennan, traveled to Somalia to report on the famine going on there. On their fourth day in country, they were captured and held for ransom by a rogue group of criminals. Amanda and Nigel then spent 15 months in captivity in increasingly brutal circumstances as their families attempted to raise the $1.5 million ransom. After a failed escape attempt in their fifth month, conditions became horrific, with every abuse imaginable. Amanda did survive, though, by creating a house in the sky in her mind, as she puts it, and that's the title of her memoir published by Scribner. Even more remarkably, after her release, Linhout returned to Somalia and created the Global Enrichment Foundation, an organization devoted to educating Somali youth to offer an alternative for youths like the child soldiers who guarded her during her captivity. The name of the book is A House in the Sky. Amanda Linhout is our guest. Amanda Linhout, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks.
Your book, A House in the Sky, details your travels growing up, your longing for travel, how that travel generated, I would say, a wanderlust, if you will, that ended up in Somalia where you were abducted. After being released and going back to Somalia afterwards, what made you decide to write about this experience?
I think that we learn from each other, and mine is a story of survival. And, you know, there is a lot of hope in a story like mine that, you know, is something we all need right now. We all need hope. And I know when life got really tough for me in 2008 and I was abducted and held hostage for 460 days, I would think about survival stories and stories of hope that I had come across, Nelson Mandela, Viktor Frankl, you know, and the lessons that I had learned from reading their books gave me strength to continue. So if there's something in my book that can be of value in the world and give others strength, I think that that's really meaningful. And I'm a reader myself. I read piles of books every month, and I always have from a really young age. And so I wanted this book to be more, though, than just a snapshot in time of the period that I was abducted in 2008 and 2009. I think it was important to let the reader know what brought me to Somalia to begin with. So as you say, I was this young woman who was full of wanderlust, who was very much a free spirit and an adventurer, traveling around the world, going to over 50 countries, having fun, learning about myself, learning who I was in the world, and that wanderlust was born from a childhood in poverty, what poverty looks like in North America. So my co-author, Sarah Corbett, and I felt like having those pieces in this book, the childhood, the early travels, which led me to Somalia, you know, were really important parts of this. And ultimately, I think, you know, it makes for a really good, nuanced read of a complex story.
Beginning of the book, you write that you had a pretty difficult childhood, and the National Geographic was the place you escaped to, because it's interesting, this whole theme of escape permeates this whole book, and that's been a part of you your whole life.
Yeah, that's right. My childhood, though, you know, I come from a very loving family, had its fair share of troubles. I lived primarily with my mother in a series of basement apartments, and, you know, she worked as a cashier at grocery stores. So money and travel wasn't something that my family had or did. And our environment was also often violent and chaotic, you know, through some of the relationships with young men that my mother was choosing to have. And so my escape from that environment was, as you say, in the pages of these National Geographic magazine. I kept a big stack of them beside my bed. And when things got really bad in the house, I would reach for them. And it was the images that I saw on those pages, these images of exotic and colorful and beautiful places all over the world, which were my window onto a world outside of this small agricultural city that I was growing up in Central Alberta. And that is where this seed of wanderlust was born. I wanted to go to the places initially that seemed the most colorful and the most exotic to me. And the very first trip I took was when I was 19 years old to Venezuela. And that trip was inspired from a National Geographic story that I had read about a mountain in southern Venezuela, Mount Roraima, that I wanted to hike to the top of. And it was that six-week trip, the very first trip that I took, which was all the affirmation, really, that I needed, that the world was this very accessible place and that I could take myself out of this small city that I was living in and have these adventures and experience these colorful and exotic places.
You know, from South America, you went to Central America, and you described this one, and I can't remember if it's in Costa Rica or Guatemala, Lake
Atitlan.
Where is that, by the way? You said it was a place where time just didn't seem to exist.
Yeah, this is a beautiful place that my best friend and I went in central Guatemala when we were in our early 20s. And, you know, those early trips were really about discovering who I was out in the world, and sometimes alone and sometimes with friends and sometimes with lovers that I had. It was a period of my life probably not unlike many other people in their 20s, where you're seeking to discover who you are. And while other young people might be in college or, you know, trying to answer that question in different ways that I was, for me it was very much about going to these places, exploring, and then seeing who I was in relation to the environment and the people and the culture around me.
And each trip you became more adventurous in your ability to negotiate in a foreign culture, I guess that's the best way to put it. And with each trip, there was a tendency to get a little further off the beaten path, Southeast Asia, from there to India, to Pakistan, eventually Afghanistan, which you have an interesting chapter which says you don't mess, I'm changing the word, but you don't mess with Afghanistan. But you did go to Afghanistan and started getting into photojournalism and reporting.
Yeah. What I was finding was the more borders that I was crossing as I was traveling around in my 20s, my confidence grew. Because what I was essentially discovering about the world is that it's not really the place that we see on TV or that we read about in the newspapers. It really everywhere, people have essentially the same values and want the same things, that people everywhere are just trying to get by. And it was very often these impoverished countries, which were home to some of the kindest people. And so I did start going into countries which are considered off-limits, places like Pakistan, Ethiopia, and Syria, and, as you say, Afghanistan. And by and large, the experiences that I was having were wonderful. And I think you believe about the world what the world shows you to be true. So, of course, I was spending so much of my life traveling, you know, small incidents here or there. There was nothing significant enough to deter me from continuing to push the envelope a little bit farther and farther and farther. And in 2004, I was in Ethiopia, and I met an Australian photojournalist named Nigel Brennan, who really inspired me to want to take my travels in a different direction. He was traveling around the world and funding his travels by taking photos and reporting on these stories, these important stories. And I thought that was something that I wanted to do too. As a young woman, I had often asked myself how I could make a difference in the world. And it felt like journalism and sharing the stories and the cultures that I was learning about could maybe be the answer to that question for me. So I bought myself a fancy camera. I took some photography classes. I based myself in Kabul, Afghanistan, and then later Baghdad, Iraq. And it was in the summer of 2008 that, after some small successes selling my work as a freelance journalist in Iraq, that I decided that I wanted to push that envelope a little bit further and go to Somalia.
Hmm. I would suppose that after negotiating Afghanistan fairly successfully, Iraq fairly successfully, where you actually were detained once there, you felt like Somalia was just a different country, about the same sort of situation.
You know, when I boarded this small plane bound for what I thought was going to be this one-week work trip, with my Australian friend, the very one that had inspired me to take up journalism to begin with, Nigel Brennan, when we boarded that plane and flew to Somalia and I got my first glimpse of the country out the window, I was astonished at how absolutely beautiful Somalia is from the sky. It has the longest coastline in all of Africa and just exquisite white sand beaches. But as soon as the plane touched down and I got off, I knew that what many of my journalist friends had told me about Somalia was true, and that it is a war zone. Unlike the other ones that I had been to, there was real palpable danger in the air in a way that I had never quite experienced before. Even having been based in Baghdad for 7 months, Somalia, Mogadishu in particular, was a really, really different place.
Can you give us a sense of why it felt different?
That morning that we flew in, what I was really struck by was the streets being completely empty. So the beauty I had seen from the sky up close was a crumbling city where every wall was pockmarked with bullet holes and buildings that had been blown away. And of course I had seen that before, but what was different was the streets were completely empty. And I asked my driver about this. I was so struck by it and this tension in the air that was so thick, you could cut it with a knife. And he sort of casually said, oh, war broke out this morning. War in a country that has been embroiled by war for 20 years. And, you know, people had died. And, you know, people were just so afraid in Mogadishu that summer of 2008 that they were, like, literally not going out of their homes. And I realized immediately that we had A, chosen a really bad time to be in Somalia. Admittedly, I'm the first person to admit that. And B, it was I sufficiently prepared for what a particularly bad time it was? It wasn't. Mm-hmm. And so I realized that as soon as we arrived.
My guest today is Amanda Lindhout. She is a traveler, a journalist who spent 15 months in captivity in 2008 and 2009 in Somalia. Today, she is the founder of the Global Enrichment Foundation to change some of the lives of some of the people she encountered during her captivity. It's working in Somalia and Kenya. And she's co-author of House in the Sky, which details her experiences with a co-writer, Sarah Corbett. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, I imagine it's just youth and headstrong nature that, you know, you felt this, but you said, well, I'm going to go do what I came here to do.
Yeah, you know, and I had been living in a war zone for 7 months. And so though I had this initial shock at this new environment being Mogadishu, you do sort of settle into the experience. You know, I had a job to do. I knew what I came there to do. And it was, you know, in my mind meant to be for 1 week. And I was going to do it. And so it was on our third day in the country that Nigel and I piled into an SUV vehicle that we had rented along with some security guards and a cameraman I had hired and a driver and a fixer, somebody who organizes things, that we set out to actually get the story that we, both Nigel and I, were interested in, which was a story about a massive internally displaced people's camp that's run by a renowned Somali activist, Dr. Hawa Abdi, an incredible woman who was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize last year. And we were going to go to her internally displaced people's camp and report on it, do interviews. We had arranged everything. And it was en route to her camp, which was just on the outskirts of the city, that as we rounded a bend in the road, I saw a car pulled over off to the side up ahead, and about a dozen armed men emerged from where they had been hiding behind that car, holding AK-47s, and our vehicle was forced to stop. And we were all pulled out, and the next thing I knew, I found myself lying face down in the dirt, spread eagle with a gun held to the back of my head, and that was the moment that the life that I had known to be mine ended, and a new one began.
Give us a sense of who your captors were. Were they a gang? Were they paramilitary? What exactly?
They were a rogue group of criminals, so they weren't affiliated with any of the larger, better known terrorist organizations in Somalia. There was essentially two groups. There was the group of young boys, some of them teenagers, one of them as young as 14 years old, who held us and guarded us day to day. And these young men were managed and controlled and manipulated even by another group, the group of commanders, as they called them, but essentially the leaders of the kidnapping operation, who were slightly older. There was a financier for the operation, a man we nicknamed Donald Trump, who would come in with food and supplies and money to keep this kidnapping operation going. And there was their communications guy, a young man named Adam, who would call Nigel and I's families sometimes weekly, sometimes daily, demanding $1.5 million for each one of us. And as I've said, I come from a family with no financial means. So in my case particularly, they may have well been asking for the moon because it was just impossible. But the young boys who were holding us captive day to day, I figured out immediately that none of them really wanted to be there. It was essentially a job for them, an opportunity in a country with very, very few opportunities. So one of the young men, Jamal, 18 years old, really couldn't wait for it to be over because he was engaged to be married to a young woman, Hamdi, that he loved very much and loved to talk about. But what I observed with this group of young boys, as time went on and their frustrations that it was taking so long grew, and they themselves were very contained in this house along with us, they became increasingly radicalized, listening to fiery propaganda coming from Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. And by the end of the 460-day period, most of those young men who, you know, at the outset had appeared to be not so unlike young people even in this part of the world, in North America, but just different set of opportunities and circumstances, really wanted nothing more than to be suicide bombers.
Mm, wow. And you watch that radicalization unfold.
Yeah.
And the book describes the toughness of your situation and the physical conditions in captivity. And when you were first captured, you were unsure why you were captured, but it became very readily apparent that it was a ransom. I guess it was almost impossible to get across the fact that you as a Westerner might have come from modest means, that $1.5 million is as big a fantasy to your family as it would have been to these young men. It must have been impossible to get that across.
Yeah, it really was. From the kidnapper's perspective, someone would pay, they were sure, whether it was our families or our government. But the reality is that the Canadian government, the same as the American government, does not pay ransoms. And so the burden of this was completely on my family's shoulders. And the Canadian government supported my family as much as they could within the confines of Canadian law. But at the end of the day, it really was up to my mom to try to figure out how she was going to get me out of there.
Now, the kidnappers were talking to your parents fairly regularly. What about yourself? Did you have any communication with your family at all?
There was really, really limited communication between my mother and I in those 15 and a half months. And the phone calls were always scripted and very short, like 30 seconds long, where the point was for me to let my mother know how terrible my situation was, how sick I was, and that if the money wasn't paid very soon, that I would be killed. So the conversations with my mom were terrifying, I think, for both of us, and they weren't an exchange of information. So, like, on my end, too, I had no sense of what was going on at home. If the money was being raised, how they would raise it, I had no information at all. And as time went on, you know, when we passed the one-year mark, I really did start to feel kind of hopeless, knowing that such a huge amount of money wasn't possible for my family, knowing the government wasn't going to pay, and really unsure what was happening on the other end.
You'd also made an escape attempt by that point, and I guess conditions really changed after that point. That was 5 months in, right?
Yeah, Nigel and I did plan and execute an escape attempt, and we write about this in detail in the book. It exhilarating and terrifying day of 45 minutes of freedom before we were recaptured. And there was really a line in our kidnapping. There was like the before the escape and after the escape. And after the escape was aftermath. It was punishment for that failed escape attempt. And Nigel and I were separated, and I was alone and locked up in a dark room where I was put in chains, and my conditions deteriorated significantly. Every aspect of that, you know, no longer receiving clean water or food regularly. And it really became a struggle to get through not a day, but to get through each minute. Yeah, extremely difficult.
Yeah. And earlier we were talking about those fantasy escapes that you sort of entertained since a child. And you mentioned earlier thinking of the trials and tribulations of somebody like Nelson Mandela. You internalized. That's how you've kept it together, I would think.
Yeah, it's what I needed to do, because locked up in this dark room, it was a room that I named the Dark House, that was pitch black, where I couldn't move my body because there had been chains wound around my ankles, and my prison was no longer the size of the room that I was held in. It was the size of the mat that I had to lay on the floor, which was 2 feet by 6 feet. And I had lost everything. I had lost my family. I had lost food. But I lost the things you think can never be taken away from you. I lost the sky. I lost the sunshine. I lost laughter and light. And I never knew if I could make it through a day. It was about making it through each minute. And you can imagine the range of emotions that a person goes through when they're living in fear at every single moment, waiting for the footsteps, wondering what is going to happen next when the footsteps come into the room. But what I found is that the mind, in a situation like that, becomes a very, very powerful thing. And harnessing the power of my mind and imagination and memory really helped me survive when things got so bad that I wasn't sure if I was going to make it, when I worried that this experience was going to break me, break the essential part of my being. I could go to my house in the sky, which was essentially a place in my mind where I could remember the life that I had lived and all of the beautiful places in the world that I had been and the friendships that I had and humanity. And I could think about the life that I wanted to go on to lead, where I could dream about the kind of life that I would build for myself if only I would survive this. It was a place that I could remember family and, through imagination, imagine sitting down at a big table and sharing a meal and food with that family that I love so much. It was my refuge. It was a saving grace. And I found that the mind, though it had the ability to transport me to my house in the sky and save me, also had the ability, if I allowed it to take me really into the depths of despair as well. And I began paying really close attention to the words that I used in my mind about the experience that I was going through. And I found that when my mind would get really stuck on the angry thoughts, the why me, the thoughts of despair and I'll never get out of here, I'm going to die here, I would immediately emotionally spiral downwards. But the other side of that is I could catch those thoughts and put new thoughts in. I could tell myself, okay, instead of that, I'll tell myself, I choose freedom. I choose peace. I choose forgiveness. I will be out of here. I am going to go home. I am healthy. And really began to focus on putting new tapes into my mind that were positive despite the horrific and brutal conditions that I was living in. And the more that I did that, the more powerful my mind became in going to those more positive thoughts when things got bad. The mind, in a situation like I was in, devoid of all stimulation, becomes very strong and muscular even.
I would think that after a year, 14 months, that would just be overwhelming. But eventually you were released, and you made some important decisions in the wake of that release. I can't imagine the process of returning to normalcy after months in a dark room like that, but you made the decision to forgive your captors And more importantly, you said you were struck by those child soldiers that you spoke of earlier in our conversation. You said, I got to do something to help those kids.
Yeah. When I was in captivity, the longer that I was there, it became really clear to me that my captors are very much a product of their environment. They've been completely shaped by the war and the violence around them, which certainly doesn't make them innocent of anything that they did, but it's just a fact. And when I was in the dark house, one of the things that I did to get through the day in my house in the sky, in thinking about the life I wanted to go on and lead, I thought about ways, however small and humble they may be, but ways that I could maybe contribute to creating some positive change in that country, which is creating these generations of young people who don't have opportunities, who don't have opportunities to have an education particularly. And I often wondered how my captors would be different if they had had the opportunity to have an education. And so when I was released, after my family had managed to fundraise enough money to bring me home, and Nigel was able to fundraise for his release, we were released together in November of 2009. And I came home and immediately began talking about this organization that I wanted to start. It was hard for people to understand how or why I would want to do that, considering how bad everything had been for me. And so I started talking about forgiveness at that time, because forgiveness was also something that I had began to choose when I was in captivity as a way to save myself. It was never something I was extending or giving to my captors. It was something I was doing for myself as a way of letting out the accumulation of anger that was building up inside of me. By understanding that they were products of their environment, I could allow myself to feel a sense of compassion and allow myself to inch closer to forgiveness. And forgiveness was also key to wanting to set up an organization, you know, because I had to be able to embrace forgiveness to move forward with that. And so it was about 4 months after I was released that I did make good on this vow that I had made to myself in captivity about if I made it out, I wanted to do something. And I established the Global Enrichment Foundation. And it was, for the first year, a bit of a one-woman show. People really struggled to understand the motivations behind it. But I never questioned whether or not it was the right thing to do. I just knew that it was. I think that when people go through times of suffering, it leads you to ask the big questions about life. And for me, what became really apparent was that if I survived, I wanted my life to be of service somehow. And so after a year of building the Global Enrichment Foundation, people started to, and successfully, people started to recognize that, you know, I was really serious about this, and it wasn't about imparting my idea about how Somalia needs to change, but working alongside the Somali communities around the world to create educational opportunities within Somalia itself. And fast forward now 4 years, and we've done that really successfully. We have programs that have reached hundreds of thousands of people in Somalia. We had a really tremendous response to the 2011 famine in Somalia, where we gave out over 2 million meals to Somalis who were starving to death during that particular tragedy. And it's a response to what happened to me that I feel proud of, and that is by choosing compassion instead of anger, it's not only something that has reached and helped all of those people across the world, it's also something that has really, really helped me along in my own recovery.
Amanda, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich.
Amanda Lindhout is the author of the memoir, A House in the Sky. It's published by Scribner. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.